Because a few of them were white, and it's the same across the nation. Black and white discrimination, yeah, and you can't understand me, and all that other jazz they hand me in the papers and TV, and all that mass stupidity that seems to grow more every day. Each time you hear something we'd say, he wants to go and do you in, cause the color of your skin just don't appeal to him, no matter if it's black or white, because he's out for blood tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aubrey Hendricks, who is a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at New York's Theological Seminary. He is the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teaching and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aubrey Hendricks.
That's my pleasure. My pleasure.
And Aubrey, I'd like to talk about how the president might build on his powerful speeches on race that many feel do not go sufficiently beyond rhetoric to address the reality of the race relations in America brought into focus by the flagrantly unjust killing of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of his killer. I take it you also share the feeling that we've got to go beyond rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I don't want to say that it's just rhetoric. I think that he made some powerful points. He took an important step in helping America to see, mostly white America to see, to understand what the real issue is and what the suffering, how deep the suffering goes and why there's such outrage. So it's always important to have, to try to facilitate dialogues by, you know, by helping mutual understanding, except, you know, there wasn't really much mutual understanding, you know, being shot for here, I think, because he was speaking to white people. Didn't have a lot to say to black people. But, you know, I'm of two minds. I guess what I find a little discomforting is that he did not really take a moral position, you know. He tried to, you know, to share both sides of the story, and, you know, he didn't make any strong commitment. Like Lyndon Johnson said, we are going to conquer poverty, you know. He came down hard like that. Now, I know it's harder for a black president to say that he's going to do something that that benefits his group. I mean, Lyndon Johnson had the benefit of being seen as being, having a disinterested interest in the welfare of poor and the black people. But the president, I think, he could have been more effective by taking a moral position about how wrong this treatment is and how it has stopped. You know, he's the president of all Americans, and there are tens of millions of Americans who face all kinds of obstacles they shouldn't every day. And he can say that, look, I'm the president of all Americans. That includes black Americans. You know, I'm fighting for gay people and obstacles to be removed from them, disabled people, women. You know, black people have obstacles, too, that that are un-American, and we're going to address all of them. But he never says it like that, you know. He never shares it with great moral conviction and passion.
Well, Aubrey Hendricks, it does seem that the president is caught between absolutely vicious and venal hatred on the right and a lot of disappointment on the left, and that in many ways, he's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't in terms of bringing up race relations and the color of his skin because, for example, a lot of progressives want him to be more tough. They want him to get out there and fight. And I imagine in many ways he's restrained from that because he doesn't want to come across as an angry black man. So yeah. To what extent do you think he is circumscribed by the – I mean, maybe you're right, though. Maybe he should step out and it would be more effective. But do you at least acknowledge the reasons for this apparent caution on his part?
I do understand. I really do. I mean, he's facing the kind of assault and obstructionism that no other president has ever face, and there's a, and it's really colored by a homicidal hatred in many quarters, of going beyond anything that's ever been seen. But you know, as we know, those who hate him are going to continue hating him anyway. I mean, he's not going to stop being black, and they're not going to. There's nothing he can do to satisfy them, and because he's made up his mind, they've made up their mind. And so I don't think that should go into deliberations. I mean, we don't know what kind of other kinds of pressures he has, you know, legislative and all that. But I mean, at a certain point, you have to take a stand and say, look, part of this problem is that the unemployment rate among African Americans is so high, unconscionably high, not because everyone's lazy, but because, you know, they're the last hired, first fired, and on down the line. You know, don't have the same educational opportunities, and then you have the profiling thing, which gets a lot of young people in the criminal justice system who don't necessarily belong there. They come out, you know, they're tainted. So, I mean, all these things are very, very important. It's not just that. I mean, he can address these kinds of things, even in the midst of all the hell that he's catching, because he's going to catch it anyway. And you know, it's like. You can't be middle of the ground all of the time. I mean, at this point, I think that many of his supporters, black and white, would be very much hardened if he would say, "Look, we just can't have this. We can't have any section of our citizenry mistreated. And I'm going to stand up as president, and I'm going to take a moral stand, like just as I've done here, there, elsewhere." That's how I see it.
Again, I'm speaking with Aubrey Hendricks, who's a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. Now, in terms of the church and obviously moral leadership, has resulted in extraordinary things. I mean, after all, the emancipation movement came out of the churches, and of course, one of the great teachings of the Bible is essentially empathy, to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I, as a white American, I was very, very moved by what the president was talking about in terms of his black experience of being followed in department stores by security people and crossing the street and hearing the locks clicking. To me, that is, you know, I thought that was a very, very good teachable moment for white Americans, and I think it struck a chord. So maybe, you know, on the one hand, as an African American, you're disappointed, but as a white American, I'm not.
Yeah, what's a good point? And let me just back up and say this: I don't have an issue with what he said. Like I said at the outset, he said some important things that have never been said before from that bully pulpit. And I think it's a great step that he has taken. But I was not as comfortable with the way that he ended the speech. In a sense, saying, "Well, there's not much that I can do as president." Well, you know, there is. I mean, if all else fails, they are executive orders, you know, but don't, you know. So he did well by spreading the responsibility, you know, among all American citizens, but he sort of poo-pooed his power to intervene. That's what makes me uncomfortable. But, you know, to hear... any man, stand up to talk about the painful plight of African Americans every day. I mean, this is still a white supremacist society. White folks have privileges I don't have. I mean, clearly, you know. I mean, one privilege is an easy privilege. You can walk in the store and not be an instant suspect.
Sure.
You know? And I knew a judge. I had a friend who was a judge. Who was arrested for shoplifting and hadn't done a thing, and detained overnight. Never would have done that to a white man or a white judge. It's obvious I'm of mixed emotions, but I guess I'll come down on this. I would rather he gave this speech than not. And I'm thrilled that he gave it. I just want to trust that this is a beginning step for him, and that he chooses to go further.
Well, but the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman situation really brings into light what you just said, that there's a double standard and a deadly double standard in this case. There's a lot more that could have been said, I think. I mean, beyond empathy, there should be some outrage, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, it's as far as the president's showing outrage, I think that's dicey. I also think, though, it can have a power. I look at presidents who've erupted with righteous indignation, and that empowers those who support him and those whose outrage he shares. Also, those are greatly teachable moments. Righteous indignation raises a lot of questions, and it wakes people up sometimes. But for him to do that, I mean, look, they call him the racist in chief because he said that black people have had these experiences. Imagine if he,
right.
if he came out and said, you know, what I'm feeling, you know. The Trayvon Martin thing was that, I mean, the Zimmerman verdict, and the way that we saw a young man, a young boy, who was murdered, and then he was tried for his own murder and found guilty, essentially, because he's a thug, you know, though he has no record or anything like that. Though Zimmerman does have a record of arrest, you know, for violence. But he had people calling him a thug, and he attacked first, and he should have left him alone. He shouldn't have jumped on Zimmerman. Well, no one was there.
Right.
And why do they take Zimmerman's word for it? Zimmerman's a grown man, and you mean that 158-pound boy, he had to kill him to get him off of him? And who said who could say that Trayvon wasn't on his back first?
Right.
Or that he wasn't hit first, and that they were, I mean, who can say that?
Well, right. The entire narrative, of course, is what they built, and as you rightly point out, there was no evidence, there were no witnesses. It is a narrative. It's not the truth, and frankly, it's a narrative that's very comfortable for white people.
Yeah, and we see that now. What the president might have said, I'm saying what he might have said was, you know, he came close. That this is just unacceptable. Too many young black men are penalized, are demonized, and are in the criminal justice system, some for no fault of their own. And that this has to stop now. We must take whatever steps as a society that we can to stop this now. But he, you know, didn't do that. He just said, you know, he understands, and I want you white people to understand what we're going through, which is important, but it's not enough because, I mean, what steps is he talking about? You know, let's talk to the police so they can have better understanding and this and that. Well, that's been going on forever.
Right.
So, that's nothing new.
Well, a lot of people, of course, you know, criticize the president in the sense that he doesn't have a traditional African-American background. His father was from Africa and his mother from Kansas, and he grew up in Hawaii and Indonesia, and he had to sort of learn his African-American cultural and social history on his own. And I guess what connected him to the black experience is simply that he is black. But he's married to a black woman. That's his universe, his family.
Right.
He talks about his wife and his family. I've met him a couple of times and with his wife, and he's, you know, there's a very, very powerful bond there. I mean, he has found his place as an African American. I think anybody has a right to question his blackness anymore.
Oh, no, not at all. And I give him a lot of credit. A lot of people do not keep in mind, and I myself have to catch myself. I have to remember, yes, he did not grow up with the day-to-day horror that I grew up. I was stopped by the Klan when I was 10 years old. I mean, I've been, man, I can't begin to tell you how often I faced harm and suffered harm and faced death at the hands of angry whites just for being black. He didn't grow up experiencing that, and that's no, so he can't really understand the depth of the suffering. I think he does, you know, he does as well as he can. He does very well. And I'm saying that to say, though, that folk cannot, we have to be careful not to try to hold him to the standard of someone who really has experienced these things and say, well, he's not saying, you know, he should be, you know, more one way and more the other way. I mean, we have to give him some room and some credit, you know, for the fact that he chooses to identify as he does, you know, with the pain of people, pain that he himself has not suffered. And that's why I think I want to put my remarks in context. I've always been a supporter of Barack Obama, and I still am. I worked in this campaign from the first day that Joshua Du Bois, his religion advisor, came on. I was working with Joshua from the beginning, and I support President Obama, you know, very strongly. But part of my support, and there's not enough going on in the black community, I think, is to share my concerns. I mean, as a patriot, as an American, I have that responsibility. So I'm not against President Obama. I want him to succeed, but I also want him to hear, you know, all sides of the story. And this is an important side of the story, I think.
Well, he just in terms of some optimism here, he did talk about his children, and I have a millennial daughter, and there's no question that the younger kids today are infinitely more post-racial than we are, and obviously this Trayvon Martin Zimmerman cases has indicated that there's a kind of delusional white comfort zone out there that people want to believe that race relations have been fixed, that it's no longer a problem in America. One of our the guest that was on before you, the criminologist and sociologist, mentioned that in many ways, I'm talking to you from Hollywood, right across the street from Universal Studios, Aubrey, and he was critical of Hollywood, in effect, for creating this kind of delusion by showing, you know, African Americans and all minorities in all of these sitcoms and everything that you see on television, et cetera, that paints a picture that reinforces this idea that it's all been fixed. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah. I think there are a lot of factors that play into the fiction that we are a post-racial society. But I think what really is the major factor here is that white America looks for any reason to not face its culpability in the current social situation. An example, I keep talking about the high rate of criminality among young black men. What they don't talk about is that young black men are arrested at a rate that's many times whites for similar infractions or non-infractions. The conviction rate is higher, but that's ignored.
Sure.
You bring that up, you say, "Oh, you're making excuses." Well, you have to look at the system. Is not a just system. That's not that's not an excuse.
Exactly. The previous guest was saying lives in an affluent white suburb of Philadelphia, and he said the police do not arrest white kids for the drugs that they carry because they consume as many drugs, if not more, than African-American kids. So the double standard is absolutely clear. And you know,
so Hollywood reflects that. Yeah. On the other hand, you know, Hollywood has played a role in showing the humanity to a lesser extent, but showing the humanity of African Americans too. You know, but Hollywood still shows us as buffoons, also not in blackface with big flap floppy shows, but many of that shows us as buffoons. But, you know, then again, maybe that's a sign that we've arrived to a certain extent.
Well, Aubrey, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us here today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, and I appreciate your work very much.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Aubrey Hendricks, who's a visiting scholar in religion and African-American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible and the Church and Body Politic. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Gideon Levy about his contention that change won't come from within unless Israel pays a price for the occupation.
No absence in the mother's arms, even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn, overcome, done and done, he gone. Shell like a bell and run, the blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged, and in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs.